Acts 22, beginning in verse 30. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why Paul was being accused by the Jews, the tribune, the Roman tribune, unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck?" Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Now, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope of the resurrection and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit. But the Pharisees, acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply, "We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him?" And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood by Paul and said, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." And now, Lord, may the reading of your word, may the meditations of our hearts be pleasing to you. Amen. What is the difference between a car accident involving a rabbit and a car accident involving a lawyer? There are skid marks in front of the rabbit. Now, what has that got to do with Acts? That joke's funny because there is some stigma or some negative connotations with lawyers and honesty. Now, Paul comes to a council, and technically, there are no lawyers there, but we begin to wonder something similar when we look at Paul's interactions with the council. In this section of Scripture, is there something going on in terms of honesty? Is this even above board? You perhaps have to begin to wonder as we read some of the details of these interactions as Paul goes before the Sanhedrin. Now, to catch us up, Paul has entered Jerusalem. He had joined with the Jerusalem church. They had told him of some negative conversation about him. The Jews were thinking that Paul was turning everyone away, all of the Jews against the Jewish belief system, and so they ask Paul to accompany a few men who are making a vow to the temple, while some Asian Jews see Paul go to the temple and accuse him of taking a Gentile into the place where Gentiles are not allowed, and so this creates an uproar. The Roman tribune has to intercede, and he does, and amidst this uproar, the Roman tribune is trying to find out what is going on. And so we come to chapter 22, verse 30. After Paul has spoken to the Roman spoken to the Jews and then spoken to the Roman Tribune about his citizenship, the Roman Tribune still doesn't know what's going on. And so Luke tells us the next day, desiring to know the real reason why Paul was being accused by the Jews. Now, probably what's going on is the real reason is there's some boundaries going, there's some obstacles. There's some religious cultural obstacles between a Gentile, the Roman, and the Jews. He doesn't completely understand. There's also a language barrier. So if Paul is speaking in Aramaic to the Jews or Hebrew to the Jews, the chances are good that the Roman Tribune has no idea what he's saying. So there's some question as what he's picked up at this point. And Luke tells us he hasn't picked up enough to know what's going on. So desiring to know the real reason Paul was being accused, whatever reasons he's heard, he wants to get to the bottom of this. He commands, quote unquote, commands that the Jewish council meets. Now he's calling for the Sanhedrin to meet, 70 or so leading leaders of the Jewish people, comprised of Pharisees and Sadducees, which we'll see in a moment. Now probably he couldn't technically command them, but they got the message. And so they convene, and Paul begins another address. And Paul's address begins in chapter 23, verse 1. Looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers," brothers as in brothers as a fellow Jew, "I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." Paul's claim is not that he's perfect, but that he has lived his life seeking God truly, both as a Jew prior, even in his story as he's persecuted Christians, he was honestly seeking God in good conscience. And then after meeting Christ in proclaiming the gospel and the resurrection, he continues to seek God in good conscience. He's not saying he's perfect or he's there yet. He's saying in good conscience he has sought God. This immediately sparks something with the high priest, Luke tells us in verse 2. And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. So we have this tension straight away. This is, if we haven't got the mood yet with all of the riots, this is not a warm, fuzzy place. And so the high priest orders him to be stricken. No doubt, there's a couple things actually probably going on here. First of all, he is striking him, assuming that Paul is on trial, quote unquote, whether this is an official trial or not. Paul is on trial for a legitimate reason. And so when Paul has said he has lived and is speaking in good conscience, at the very least, what Paul has done is lied. And that, and Ananias, as the high priest, is basically calling him out on it. There is a chance that it's more than that, and the high priest is seeing further, not only a lie, but a blasphemous lie, in that Paul is perpetuating and communicating things about God and about God speaking to people that are just not true, and he's saying he's doing this in all good conscience. And so this quasi-blasphemous claim is checked, and Paul is literally stricken, literally slapped across the face. Then Paul responds by striking back verbally. Now here is where in the age of text messages, if you've ever received a text message or given a text message, there has been a moment where you are typing or reading something and you think to yourself, how do I type that in a way that conveys the tone and the emotion? Or did they really mean that, or were they kidding? And you can't tell because of the limitations of text. We understand this. In some sense, this is where we are at here. We cannot completely tell Paul's tone in response. He is certainly verbally striking back to the high priest Ananias when he responds. There is no mincing of words in verse 3. Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall." Now, at this point, Ananias was not thinking to himself, "Now, was he kidding?" No, he was not kidding. He was caught. Now, and even then, as we read it, we think about Jesus talking to the Pharisees at one point and referring to them as whitewashed tombs. The image is a vivid one. You dress up the outside and it looks nice while the inside is crumbling. You cover the fence filled with dry rot. You covered it with paint and yet the dry rot continues to eat away. You whitewashed tomb. There's nothing living inside of you and yet you have the facade of life and relationship with God. It's a vivid description. Paul's not kidding. So he strikes back, "God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you ordered me to be struck?" Here's what Paul is saying. Paul is saying essentially that what Ananias, what you have done is you have broken the law by judging me before I've even had any sort of say in the matter. And instituting a consequence for a sin that I haven't even been convicted yet of. You have broken the law. And so Paul strikes back verbally. That part is clear, this interchange. What comes next is interesting. Because those who are around, the rest of the council, immediately exhort Paul. And they ask him, almost aghast, those who stood by, verse 4, "Would you revile God's high priest?" In other words, you of all people who are claiming to live in good conscience as a Jew and otherwise should know this is God's high priest and he, as God's high priest, deserves respect. How could you do so? How could you say such a thing? So there's this question. And Paul's response is interesting. And Paul says, "I didn't even know, brothers, that he was the high priest." Now, this is the point where we're not sure how to respond, because the question is, and a good question is, how in the world could Paul not? Did Paul indeed, is he saying that he didn't recognize Ananias? Literally, he didn't know this was the high priest? Amidst the ceremony, well, perhaps there wasn't ceremony if it wasn't a technical, oh my goodness, I'm at a loss for words, trial. Then there perhaps wasn't ceremony. But amidst the council, knowing this was the Sanhedrin, understanding having been a Jew, having been a Pharisee, certainly Paul would have known the setup. Certainly Paul would have known this was the high priest leading the Sanhedrin. That's the way things went. This wasn't unusual. How is it that Paul could say he didn't know that he was a high priest? I didn't recognize him. Did he not shave that day? Or did he shave? And it seems perhaps for some far-fetched. And so there is some question here as to whether Paul actually literally didn't recognize him. But there's another alternative. There's a possibility that here's what Paul is saying, and this is where we can't tell from the text itself. And we have to have some discernment. It is possible that what Paul is saying is, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest," based upon his actions, based upon the fact that he was acting in the way he was acting, which was not the way you would act as a high priest. His actions and his demeanor and the way he was carrying himself and everything that was going on was not befitting a high priest. And so Paul is pulling this out in his reply and saying, how could I know based on the sham of what's going on and the fact that he did what he just did? That's not the way a high priest should respond. It seems, if I had to choose, it seems as if that's what Paul is saying. And yet, he continues, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. In other words, Paul is saying, I respect the office of the high priest. I respect what's going on and what should happen. And that I would definitely follow that as a good Jew, as someone who respects God's order and submits. Definitely. But what that's not what this is. I'm not following that. And so it seems that Paul is verbally striking back in a way that points out that this is not honoring to God, and they are not indeed submitting to God in terms of the way that it is intended. And so that is the introduction. And then Paul, actually Luke just in mind, it makes a paragraph. Now, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees, so that has apparently been resolved. That is the end of that conflict, and so now it is Paul's turn to respond. And so Paul begins his response, and Luke just simply says, Paul responds with one sentence, and then there's this explosion. And he gives some background comment as to why Paul says what he says. Now, when Paul perceived, verse 6, that one part were Sadducees and the other part were Pharisees. Again, the Sanhedrin was probably primarily made up of Sadducees. There were a portion of Pharisees as well, some of the scribes. And so there were a mixed group of Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, why that is significant, we don't know yet, but Luke actually tells us in a moment. If we don't know anything about Pharisees and Sadducees, right now, we know that it's going to be significant. There's a difference, and Paul seems to be strategically using this difference. And so he cries out, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. Then Luke goes on and tells us that the reason this is significant is because Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Pharisees, as a group, believed in a general end-time resurrection. So Paul, the resurrection Paul is talking about is not quite that. But they are open to his ideas because of the concept. They don't shut him down immediately. While the Sadducees, and again, that is why they are sad, you see, is because they do not believe in a resurrection. So there is immediately a possibility for a disagreement. And that is, in fact, what happens. Again, there is a question. Did Paul use this primarily as a strategy to incite the disagreement? It seems the way that Luke writes it is that Paul, in some way, is being savvy to his audience. And so he does say what he says on purpose. It's intentional. But is it intentional to incite disagreement? I'm not sure that that's true. In fact, I think that what is intentional is that Paul is trying to keep the main thing the main thing. I am a Pharisee, the son of Pharisees. Now remember, he's been on trial for going into the temple and discounting everything that is Jewish. The temple, the law. And so he says, I am a Pharisee. He established his biography earlier in the previous chapter. So that's nothing new. Then he states the fact of why he, from his perspective, is on trial. Now this does two things. Technically, it states the fact of why he's on trial. But more importantly, I think, for Luke and for Paul, it states the centrality of why he is on trial. It is respect not to the law of Moses. It is respect not to in respect not to the temple primarily. It is not in respect to the customs of the Jewish people. It is in respect to the hope of the resurrection from the dead that I am on trial. I.e., if I could summarize everything about the gospel and what we're about, it's about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I am on trial for that. Now, did it have to do also with the fact that there were Sadducees and Pharisees? The text seems plain that that is a dynamic. But I think that one of the things Paul is doing is reminding the council again of what he is truly being about, and that is, he is about the message of the gospel, the resurrection, the God of the Old Testament, who is the God of the Messiah, who is the God of life. As I was doing some reading and studying, I came across this idea for an illustration. It was a reference to an artist by the name of Adolf Menzel. I'd never heard of him. But he began creating a piece of art, a painting. It was entitled Frederick the Great's Address to His Generals Before the Battle of Leuthen. A very concise, short title. Interestingly enough, Adolf Menzel created this painting by painting the generals, by painting the crowd. So he began by painting the scenery and painting the crowd and painting the group of people and painting the generals. But what's fascinating about this piece of art is that it remains unfinished. And so for whatever reason, Menzel never got around to painting actually Frederick the Great giving the address. And so I was intrigued and I had to look it up. And so I looked it up, and it's a fascinating piece of work because in the middle of this crowd of people, there's this white spot, this blank, this empty space where the main character is supposed to be, but he's not there. Paul refuses to miss the main character. Amidst everything that's going on, illegally perhaps, at least unfairly, Paul refuses to miss the main character. And so he says it's the hope of the resurrection that's the centrality of this all. It's the gospel of Jesus. It's a good reminder. Amidst the injustice, amidst the things of the world, amidst everything else, do we center upon the main character? Amidst the people around us, especially during Christmas, the busyness and everything we have to do, we can't miss the main character. The hope of the resurrection from the dead that I'm on trial. And that's as far as he gets. We don't know what else he was going to say. Because there comes this dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Luke tells us the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in spirits. Now, there's some question as to what Luke means by that. The Sadducees held to the first five books of the Old Testament. They didn't hold to the resurrection. But it's not readily apparent that they just wholesale rejected spiritual beings. So Luke means something about that they didn't believe in angels in this context. Perhaps it's angels in terms of the end time resurrection and the working of the angels, but they disagreed with what was going on. In contrast, Luke tells us there were even a portion here in the Sanhedrin of the Jews who, wait a minute, they were checking themselves. If you look in verse 9, after this great clamor arose, some scribes in the Pharisees' party stood up and they contended effectively for Paul, basically. We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him. In other words, they don't necessarily believe Paul's message, but they will not shut down the idea that perhaps Paul had a heavenly visitation. So they open up that door and there becomes this argument so great that the Roman tribune notices and thinks there's going to be violence. And so he withdraws Paul from the council. And so it ends quickly. All of this, Luke tells the story, among other things, to set up what God is doing in Paul's ministry. And we see that in the next section, which is just one verse. Verse 11, Luke notes, "The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, 'Take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, you must testify also in Rome.'" Now, sometimes I read through these and I try to imagine, and I wonder what Paul was feeling at the moment. There are so many different places where Paul is, well, in the prison epistles, for example, Paul will talk about those who have abandoned him and those who have stood by him. And he'll talk about the way the body of Christ comes alongside of him. And he was in house arrest in Rome, which is coming. Spoiler alert, Paul actually goes to Rome, is coming. But he was able to have visitors. And so he talked about how they were an encouragement to him. I imagine that. And then in the context here, I think about how utterly alone Paul is. And yet Jesus shows up in this vision and says, "Hold on, take courage. God is sovereign. It's not spinning out of control, even though it may seem as if it is. You couldn't even finish your speech. Because I am with you." I think of that passage in Matthew chapter 28, in fact. We call it the Great Commission. Go and baptize. Making disciples of all nations. And then Jesus says this. He says, "And lo, I am with you always." And then Jesus comes back to Paul in this moment and he says, "Oh, in case you forgot, I'm with you always." It's not going to go the way you... Now, keep in mind, Paul intended, Paul wanted to go to Rome. He's been longing to go to Rome. And in effect, Jesus comes and says, "You're going to Rome. It may not happen the way you think it's going to happen, but keep in mind, I'm sovereign. I've got this thing, and you're going to Rome, and you're going to Rome to fulfill the very mission I called you to." And what was that mission? But to proclaim, to testify. And I find it interesting that the verse says to testify to the facts. To tell the objective, true, real story. It's not just facts, but sometimes we forget in the midst of Christmas, sometimes we forget that it is a true story that really happened somewhere in the Middle East. It is Easter time when that comes. It is a true story that really happened somewhere in the Middle East. There's an empty tomb. We can bank on that. We can go back to that because it really happened in history. I want you, Paul, to tell the story of the facts that happened. Contrary to the common narrative of our culture, Christianity is an objective, it's based in objective truth. "Well, yeah, but that's your truth, and that's the way you believe, and you can believe those spiritual things." Yes, yes, we can. Thank God we can. But we believe them because they are based upon objective truth. They're based upon a true individual, God in the flesh, Jesus, who walked upon this earth, and we can think through those things and we can find evidence for our faith. And so Jesus comes in this vision and says, "Take courage, because God is sovereign and God will do what he says he's going to do." Jesus' presence is with him. It's been a long time. But if you've ever had the experience, you'll never forget the sensation. As you walk into that crowded space, whatever it is, you're not alone, you're with your family, and all of a sudden you feel that little tiny hand slip up into yours. Or perhaps it's so little it just has to grab that finger of your son or your daughter, and it's an intimate communication of presence. It's the reaching up of the hand. In essence, Jesus says to Paul, and we can bank on it because it's a theological truth, lo, I am with you always. Slip your hand, tiny as and weak as it may be, into mine, because I am with you. And so Paul shares, or Jesus shares that message. And then we get to the next section. Verse 12, it was day, and the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. And so we go from this trial, impromptu maybe, perhaps, Paul's vision, to the plot to kill Paul. Some of these Jews, perhaps some of them on the council, but some of them who had been in the riot were so serious that they came together. The story tells us 40 plus of them came together and they made an oath. That word oath comes with the word of anathema. They had a strong oath. We will not eat or drink until he is dead. And there were more than 40, he tells us in verse 13. And so they go to the chief priests and the elders and they tell them, verse 14, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly and were ready to kill him. There's some irony here, perhaps humor if it weren't so dire. The Jews, who want to murder Paul, value honesty and oaths, number one. That's ironic. And they go to the religious council of the land to conspire. In other words, in order to murder Paul, they are trying to bank on their honor and their religious heritage. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, but it is meant to sort of get at us at how backwards and upside down this is. And so they make this plot, and I find it humorous because the plot does not come to fruition because God has placed Paul's nephew, we see in verse 16, in place to eavesdrop and hear the story. And so the nephew goes to Paul, and Paul sends the nephew then to the Roman tribune, and he shares the plot. And so the plot is foiled, and I often wonder to myself, whatever happened to those 40 men? Did they indeed not eat or drink? According to the law, it was such an oath, they should have kept it, unless there is the caveat that there were unforeseen circumstances outside of their control. I think God's sovereignty is definitely that. But it's foiled. And so the plot is given, the seriousness of it is given, and yet it is foiled. God, through Paul's nephew, brings the report to the tribune. The tribune's response is noted then in verse 23. The tribune then called two centurions and said, get ready, 200 soldiers. Now he took this seriously. Listen to how many he sent. 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. So he then sends this group of soldiers to take Paul at the third hour of the night. That would have been 9 p.m. So apparently there's some urgency and he seriously takes this threat and he sends him to Caesarea. We see why Caesarea, because the governor Felix is in Caesarea. This is now where Paul is going to trial. So Luke is moving Paul along in this story. And the tribune, now we know his name in verse 26, Claudius Lysias, sends a letter. This would have been protocol to send a letter with the charges to the official. So he sends a letter. The letter is intriguing in that it is true. And yet it clearly favors the tribune. Listen a bit to it. Verse 27. This man was seized by the Jews, true, and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with soldiers and rescued him. Well, he leaves out a whole bunch of parts, but he did. Having learned that he was a Roman citizen, again, forgot the part about almost beating him, as a Roman citizen, but true nonetheless. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and so on and so forth. And so he sends this letter. And the soldiers then, Luke tells us, go as far as Antipatris, verse 31, where a contingent of them return to Jerusalem, and the rest of them continue on, verse 32, to Caesarea, where Paul is put in prison. And then the letter is brought to Felix, the governor. And he notes, verse 34, on reading the letter, the governor asked what province Paul was from. And when he learned he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. So Luke brings us along on this journey and sets us up for the next trial, telling us effectively through Jesus' words where we are going, and that is Rome, geographically. And telling us in verse 11 effectively why we are going there, and that is because God in his sovereignty is using these unforeseen negative circumstances to affect his will. God is sovereign even over those things. And finally showing Paul again the truth, the rock solid truth that we can be reminded of, that Jesus is present amidst this and with us always. There's a story of a elderly Sunday school teacher. She was volunteering to teach the toddlers, the fours and fives. And she happened to be teaching them about the tabernacle and the temple. And so she was teaching them about the temple. And she got to the part of the temple where they had built Solomon's temple. And God's presence descended on the temple. And no sooner did she say those very words than those four-year-old and five-year-old's eyes got huge. And they began to grin. And they were so excited. And as a teacher, she was just pleased as could be until she realized just a second or two later that they heard presence and they got gifts. And in those 4 and 5 year olds' minds, they saw a building filled with God's gifts to them, and they could not wait for that moment. God's presence. Now, perhaps we think the same way and we want God's stuff rather than God's presence. But as we grow, probably in age and in maturity, we begin to realize that God's presence actually is the gift. And that is what Paul was given in this one verse, in verse 11. But I would also submit to you that as Paul, as we read his letters, we can make the case clearly that God's presence is communicated in more than just a vision. It's communicated through his word. It's communicated through his people. In other words, God's presence is communicated in so many different ways. And so perhaps one of the takeaways today is this. Number one, the promise is true for you and for me still. Jesus is with us always. And number two, that often looks different in different ways at different times. And not only can you and I be comforted by that, but as Jesus' followers, as his hands and feet, you and I are called to sometimes be his presence to others, to be that encouraging note or hand or hug or Bible verse or just there, reminding someone that they can just slip their hand into Jesus because he is always present. Lord, thank you. Thank you for your presence. That it's your presence that brings hope and joy and life and peace. Your presence that nobody can take away. God, we often want tangible things. We often want something we can touch that came at Christmas. But only as a signpost to point us to the true presence. As a way to make it possible for us to enter into truly in relationship with you. And so thank you for that reminder. This week, may we celebrate that presence, that you are with us always, ever present. And then would you open our eyes as your people for the opportunities for us to communicate that presence, to share that presence with someone else by being present through an encouraging word or whatever you bring to our hearts. Thank you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.